Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, and welcome to The Tonight Show. Well, ahead of his likely election as Taoiseach tomorrow, Simon Harris promises a boost for businesses, but at what cost? Plus, who has the government's ear? We debate whether NGOs command a greater influence over government than grassroots voters. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said a date is set for the invasion of the Gazan city of Rafah, in which over 1 million Palestinians are seeking refuge. Can he be stopped? This evening, Leo Varadkar travelled to Arras and Uachtaráin to formally tender his resignation to President Michael D. Higgins. This paves the way for the likely election of Simon Harris tomorrow when the Dáil resumes from its Easter recess. Speculation is rife as to who may benefit from the Taoiseach designate's impending cabinet reshuffle. Meanwhile, businesses could be in line for a 70 million euro support package, and employees could see plans to increase sick leave paused. Well, joining my panel to discuss this is Ireland editor with the Irish Independent, Fiona Sheehan, General Secretary of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, Owen Reedy, and Chief Executive of the Irish SME Association, Neil MacDonald. You're all very welcome to the programme. Fiona, you've come fresh, maybe not so fresh, from the Fine Gael Ardèche this weekend, where there was a lot of talk about small businesses. What did you learn, I suppose, about Simon Harris and whose vote he's going to be chasing?
Yeah, he was supposed to set out his vision and values in his keynote address, and it kind of turned into a fairly bland, single transferable leader's address to an Ardèche, very similar to many we've heard over the years, where he went through what he would regard as the key demographics as he identified them. So he went through his priorities, and it seemed that there was an attempt to kind of refocus Fine Gael towards, you know, again, you want to cover your main areas like housing and so on, but back to your rural Ireland base, back to your small business base, back to people who care about law and order. And they would be areas that people within the back benches and the grassroots of the party say, look, we've had a lot of slippage in those areas in recent times. If we're going into a general election, they're the areas that you need to nail down. The old woke agenda hasn't won you a whole lot of votes over the years, so let's abandon all that stuff. And ultimately, he did dish out a lot of what the audience wanted to hear in that regard. On the one hand, he was talking about support for farmers and the extension of the exemption on the nitrates directive, and then a minute later, climate change is fierce important.
So a lot of policy areas we're actually still quite in the dark?
Yeah, we are. And there was a fair amount of stuff that, as you went through it, you could draw up a list of, well, these are things that are achievable in the next year, maybe, or you can put a renewed focus on them. And these are things that are called the general election manifesto. I mean, when he announced, we will announce a new five-year tax reform package, you're kind of looking at him going, that's called a general election manifesto.
In the autumn, I think he says specifically, people think there might be an election coming.
So that's not going to be anything that's going to be within the lifetime of this government. And that's the nature of where he's at now. I mean, he's got very little scope. If he's talking about getting people who are paying the lower rate of tax to be able to earn up to 50 grand before they go into the higher rate, well, that's at 42 grand at the moment. The best, and as far as that is going to go in the next budget, will be 44 grand. So you're talking about years and years and years after that. Likewise with housing targets, if you're hoping to hit 35,000 this year, you're not going to be getting anywhere near 50 until several years to come.
Okay.
So it was that combination of, in his final year, trying to set out a few things and prioritise policies for the party, but also he's got one eye in the election.
And just very briefly, he did mention, as I said, these small businesses, and we did get a bit more information today about what prioritising or supporting small businesses who say they are in trouble might look like.
Yeah, so it was one of the things that he very much put an emphasis on, and it has been coming from feedback within his own party as well, that a lot of small businesses have been struggling. Particularly seems to be a change of mindset since the start of the year at the very latest. So the view is that it won't be a mini budget, but there will be some form of package. He himself is pointing out in his speech that there's a quarter of a billion available there in terms of supports. And we're now looking at a package of supports in the coming weeks. That will in some way ameliorate the pressures on small business, whether that's VAT rates, whether that's extra grant aids, whether it's specifically targeted funding for actual individual sectors. That all has to be teed out.
OK, and Neil, one of the other suggestions that was being made in the papers today was that there could be this pause to an increase in the number of sick days that an employee would be entitled to be paid for. Is this what your organisation is looking for?
It's part of a range of measures, Ciara. And just to follow up slightly on what Fionnán said there about the Fine Gael Ardèche, what was striking in the business session that I was invited to attend was the very straight talking that was done by Fine Gael small business owners to their own ministers, Minister Coveney and Richmond. I'm not sure they had been eyeballed to that extent. I think they were quite taken aback at the degree of emotion that was given to them by small business owners.
And what environment do they say is creating this pressure on small businesses?
Between the minimum wage, which is not just, I think there, you know, in some of the data that was presented by the Department of Enterprise coming from Maynooth University, for example, last year, they said this will only affect people on the minimum wage, not taking into account that actually the minimum wage, as Owen's members will appreciate, this ratchets or acts as a benchmark for wages in excess of €30,000 a year. That was not appreciated at all. So between that, sick pay, you know, in the service business, when someone takes a sick day, it's not just a matter of paying them for a sick day. You also have to pay another person to deliver the service in childcare or nursing homes or whatever.
So should that be taken off the agenda altogether, just to be clear, Neil, or do it need to be delayed? Is that what you're looking for?
Well, what we're saying is we've had such a significant adjustment. We've had typically 3 years of financial adjustment to the minimum wage in 1 year. So it's going to take, I don't think anyone's talking about reducing, knocking back the minimum wage as happened during the great financial crash. So people are not going to go back to 11.30 an hour. But people are saying, folks, it's going to take a long time for businesses to absorb this. And unfortunately, you know, if you look at the PwC figures, at least 1,000 plus businesses are not going to be able to absorb those costs at all.
OK, Owen Reedy, you described this potential pause to additional sick pay as a kick in the teeth for low-paid workers.
I think so, Ciara. I mean, there are a lot of low-paid workers who maybe are locked out from trade unions by the veto that the employers have in this state, unlike others, who don't enjoy sick pay schemes like most unionised workers. We know they're disproportionately young, they're disproportionately female, and they're the people who get up early in the morning. We've heard a lot about that as well, you know, the people who get up early in the morning working in retail and hospitality. And I think if we pause this sick pay on them, you're looking at a situation where there's a breach of trust. The sick pay scheme we're talking about is very modest. 25 of the 27 European member states have it. This is about bringing Ireland into line. Neil talks about the costs that are coming at business. Auto enrolment is going to be staggered over a 10-year period. The living wage, 4 years. Sick leave, 4 years. It didn't just come out of the thin air. These are labour market reforms that the state should do when things are good. And if there are certain businesses that need supports, by all means, but okay, target it. Don't have this blanket approach where you say we're going to pause it for everybody.
OK, so, Neil, look, these aren't being introduced overnight. First of all, they've been talked about for years and they're being phased in over a number of years. And actually, employers have had a quite good, I think, is what Owen is saying, in Ireland, we're simply playing catch-up with the rest of Europe.
No, not at all. And in fact, Ireland is the fourth highest wage jurisdiction in Europe. It's the second highest for the national minimum wage after Luxembourg. And these things actually don't drive the average wages in the economy. If you look at the highest wage economy in the EU, it's Denmark. Denmark doesn't have a minimum wage. Mm. So what actually drives prosperity is prosperous businesses. And at this point in the economic cycle, now this is important, Ciara, you know, with this much fraught and that looking at the price rises we're seeing, there should be people opening businesses all over the place. We're seeing people withdrawing from services, withdrawing from the hospitality industry, withdrawing from childcare.
OK, Owen's shaking his head here beside you. He's
if the facts don't suit Owen, that's unfortunate. Well, but we are seeing businesses closing.
I think Neil and his colleagues are to be congratulated for incredible PR since January of this year. Spin and no substance. Yes, there are coffee shops and restaurants closing, but twice as many are opening up. Employment increased by 3.5% last year. In hospitality, twice that, 7%. So, you know, we don't want to see anyone lose their job. We don't want to see any business going out of business.
So do you not buy the argument then from it's not an from argument, Neil, that Ciara, jobs will be lost here? Well, we need to protect the jobs, not improve the terms and conditions.
Of course we need to protect the jobs, but we've 2.71 million people at work. The numbers in hospitality are up 7%. Mm. Neil talks about PricewaterhouseCoopers and job losses. Last year, there were 27 per 10,000 business failures. Over the previous 20 years, it was twice that, including the great economic recession. We need a level of balance here and less hysteria. There are certain problems.
Is this hysteria from...
Well, to say that a modest sick pay scheme that 25 of our 27 peer countries in Europe enjoy should be paused. To say, as Neil's organisation says, that the minimum wage should be pegged at consumer price inflation. What, so low-paid workers should never aspire to an increase above inflation in this society? Are we really saying we can't have a hospitality sector unless it's on poverty pay?
Owen is quoting figures in the hospitality industry that apply to the whole of 2023, OK? The 6 and 7% that he's quoted. That does not apply to what we've seen since the adjustment in the VAT. So the adjustment in VAT has hit retail and hospitality very severely since it came in. You will not see those kind of job gain figures applying throughout 2024.
But he's saying, I suppose, that for every business that closes, that's natural churn, another one is opening. And we are hearing, I suppose, from the government time and time again, the economy is buoyant and the job market is...
At a macro level, that's true, Ciara. When you're at full employment and someone loses their job in a coffee shop, there is someone else that's hiring them. The problem is that these do not net off in the same business. So when a childcare facility is closing now, there isn't another childcare facility replacing it. When a nursing home closes, they're taking in refugees. They're not taking in nursing home patients anymore. So okay, we are seeing displacement in a great proportion of the service industry.
For the last decade, Ciara, we have seen businesses getting a lot of support, whether it was Brexit, Ukraine, COVID, cost of living crisis, many of which we supported because it supported employment. The real issue here is businesses in Ireland are undertaxed. Neil's colleagues pay about 50% of what employers in Europe pay when it comes to PRSI. Businesses are well subsidised here. If there's a particular problem, target it, but don't have this blanket approach where you penalise everybody. The labour market has to work for workers as well as employers.
OK, Fiona, and to the point, I suppose, that Owen was making there, look, at Fine Gael are pro-business, but they've also said that they're going to make work pay. That's a Fine Gael priority. Mm. Is there a bit of a clash here in these two policies?
Well, they have the advantage at the moment that you have got fairly healthy coffers. So if a problem like this comes along where you're being told the implementation of a policy that will benefit workers is causing pain on the business side, well, then you can open up the purse strings and ameliorate it for a period. They have the advantage that the subsidies that were in place during COVID-19 did show that in a very rapid period of time, you can actually put supports and grants in place targeting specific industries. So if this, if the extension of something like sick leave is an agreed public policy, it's already been initiated. I don't see any change of Taoiseach altering that substantially, but I think the implementation of it, there's very definitely going to be scope for measures to be put in place there.
But to that point that Owen was making, Neil, is there just now an over-reliance on supports from businesses in this country?
The businesses were supported through the pandemic because government shut them down. We had one of the hardest lockdowns during COVID of any country in the world. That's just a fact in terms of duration.
But so, the idea that they, I suppose, became reliant on them, that if there's any sort of tougher measures, they expect support.
No, what happened during the pandemic was the government introduced liquidity that preserved employment, and employers preserved employment throughout the pandemic. What has happened, though, is that balance sheet damage that was done in 20 and 21 has not been repaired, and now the revenue is looking for the money back. They moved it from the profit and loss account to the balance sheet, and now that money has been called back. That is part of the problem we're seeing now.
OK, what businesses need support? Who needs to be targeted?
Typically, those that are have a much higher labour component. That's services and hospitality, that's childcare, that's nursing home care. These are what are called ratioed services, because the state defines the number of employees you have to have to the number of children or the number of patients in a nursing home. Their cost base is fixed and rising, but their income isn't, and they're the ones getting squeezed.
Okay, so back to that point, we need to protect those sort of essential services, like the nursing home providers, like childcare providers.
Well, of course, we need to protect industry, we need to protect jobs, of course, but I thought it was interesting that Neil raised Denmark as not having a national minimum wage. The Danes do it differently. Employers and unions sit down together and collectively bargain. In Ireland, Neil's members and IBEX members have a veto on those kind of things.
Okay, Neil, you've laughed a couple of times at that comment.
Even when workers join the union, they have a veto. So let's do it the Danish way. I'd be up for that.
Have to admire Owen's neck, because, you know, the one sector that's is prevented from sitting down with workers and unions is the small enterprise sector. Our employers employ 60% of the national workforce, and we're not represented on the labour Employer Economic Forum. That's outrageous.
That's a matter for the employers to sort out amongst themselves. What I'm talking about is, the Joint Labour Committee, sectoral bargaining, things that most mature, progressive countries in Europe do, but for some reason in Ireland we seem to have a problem with that. We need to get over that.
Fiona, I just want to move on to some of this. I mean, we're calling it fevered speculation. I don't know if everybody at home was talking about this, but certainly everybody in political and media circles is looking at what's going to happen over the next 48 hours in terms of these cabinet appointments to senior cabinet positions and indeed to junior ministries. So, first of all, is Helen McEntee safe? And is Peter Burke the dead cert? Is that the two that we're pretty sure of at this point? Dead cert for promotion.
Dead cert for promotion. And if you were looking at the bare minimum that Simon Harris could do, then you slot Peter Burke straight in to the Department of Enterprise. And then you pick the other minister for elevation from Hildegard Nocton, Jennifer Karen McNeill and Patrick O'Donovan.
Not Neil Richmond.
No, I think we're down to three now.
Okay.
In terms of the plum posts of that second cabinet elevation position, which is the higher education position, and then the chief whip's job could have a knock-on effect there if Hildegard Nocton is to get promoted. It's quite historic. It's the first time a proposal has gone to government from Simon Harris without being leaked in advance. I mean, that's happened before. He's keeping his cards close to his chest, but we're well aware now of who exactly is in contention. And if there was a lot of speculation, I suppose, last week about what was going to happen with Helen McEntee, and was there going to be a wider reshuffle, that would appear to have narrowed down quite substantially over the course of the weekend.
So at this stage, what's your prediction? Who's going where?
Is
geography his big...
Yeah,
he spoke
yesterday about about geography, gender. He left out genes, which does tend to play a role as well in terms of political dynasties do tend to carry a weight as well. But he spoke about ability, and there are issues there. If you're putting somebody new into a department, it will take them a while to settle in. And to understand what exactly is happening. So he hasn't upset anybody thus far, because Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney went voluntarily. He starts upsetting people tomorrow.
So it's about trying to preserve this stability and this pretty jubilant mood that we saw over the weekend, certainly within the party.
He will have people telling him, don't rock the boat here. So if he's leaving Helen McEntee, plus Heather Humphrey staying and shows of protection, plus Pascal Dunne, who's staying,
in public expenditure, then it looks like he's trying to make the minimal amount of disruption here to his lineup. In terms of which of those three wins, in inverted commas, that seems to change on a daily basis.
OK, and finally, Leo Varadkar, as we said at the top of the programme, went to Ursula Nuchter and handed in his resignation and becomes a backbench TD again tomorrow. In his, I think, probably final interview we saw this evening on the news, did you feel he was signalling that he's going to bow to politics?
Yeah, I'd be shocked, if anything, if he was going to... If you're going to say, I think you get the local and European elections out of the way, you have a better idea then who your replacement is going to be too, because there are councillors out there, Siobhan Shovlin, Ted Leddy, who's a sidekick of his as well. You get a fair indication out of that, okay, these people are actually ready to kind of take that next step.
Fine Gael, and then Costa, Dell, good times.
Yeah, Fine Gael should be handily able to hold a seat in a constituency like that, even without Leo Varadkar.
All right, look, we're going to leave that conversation there for now. My thanks to Eoin Reedy and to Neil McDonald for joining us. After the break, we're going to debate whether NGOs have too much influence over government. Stay with us. Back. Well, now, from their work with everyone from minorities to migrants and the impoverished, NGOs provide vital advice and services on a plethora of issues to some of the most vulnerable in society. But in recent years, some have asked whether these organisations have amassed too much influence over the government. Well, here to discuss NGOs' relevance and role is Ireland editor with the Irish Independent, Fionnuala Sheehan, human rights lawyer and former CEO of the Rape Crisis Centre, Nolene Blackwell, and former chair of the housing agency, Conor Skehan. You're both very welcome to the programme. To come to you on this, Fionnuala, we have a new political party in Ireland, Independent Ireland, which some people will be familiar with, and they have said that they want to, you know, tackle what they say is this overspend and this waste of taxpayers' monies, and they specifically mention NGOs. They say they need to be streamlined. Why do you think they're targeting them?
Well, which ones do they want streamlined? Concern, Trocara, Gold? Do they want less working in the third world area? Do they want to abolish Vincent de Paul, the worker with impoverished people? So, I mean, it's kind of, they're throwing this concept out there, and that's fine around transparency and savings, but unless they want to actually go into a list and say which ones are not deserving of support, it's just kind of populist claptrap, really.
Well, they say there's 33,000 NGOs in this country and there must be streamlining. And fairness, I think there's lots of political parties that throw out these sort of general policy areas and they don't give detail. They don't back it up.
Well, that's their job. It's called policy formulation. So, I mean, I presume they mean they want to get rid of either the IFA or the ICMSA, because they're both NGOs. They would in some form be getting direct exchequer funding, but they tend to be getting funding around grants or other forms of support. So,
many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'd like to hear which ones they're talking about there. But yeah, in general, their
point is... Why do you think it's populist? What makes this populist?
Because you can just throw out a generalisation that these NGOs are the root of all evil and we should get rid of a load of them without actually specifically going into what ones do you not want to have support. So I agree with him on issues of transparency. It should be blatantly obvious when you go to any charity, any NGO, any organisation, this is exactly who we are, and this is exactly where we get our funding from, and the taxpayer funds us to this degree. I'm not calling RTE an NGO, but that's a classic example as well of a debate recently where we don't exactly know where Exchequer funding is going. And I often find that to be quite awry. But, I mean, one NGO that has been often in the headlines in recent times as a result of the referenda is the National Women's Council of Ireland. And they've been coming under quite a lot of fire, and they're too close to the government. But yet, 12 months ago, they were too anti-government because they weren't inviting anybody from the government to one of their rallies where Mary Lou McDonald was speaking and Ivana Baciu was speaking. So, you know, there's a wee bit of inconsistency there. We also, you know, if there needs to be tightening up of transparency, we have a lobbying register. We have got, there could be better data centrally provided in terms of funding. So there's a lot can be done there, apart from throwing out a generalisation about all the NGOs, they're really running the country.
OK, Conor Skehan, do you believe that they have these NGOs, these 33,000 bodies, that they have undue influence, I suppose, on the government? Because I think everybody accepts they have some influence.
Well, there's an old phrase that you'll never get the right answer to the wrong question. So we have to stop just from the beginning by mixing up the word NGO and charities. They're completely different things. And the kinds of figures you're talking about are a willful combination of those two sets of things. That's the first thing. To your point about asking questions, be very careful when you ask a question that you're ready for the answer. So for instance, in terms of saying we want to know who spends what, we also need to ask how many people are doing the same thing. How many charities exist for exactly the same purpose? Are they all doing it as well as it could be done? Is it serving the community that they set themselves up to serve? Are they spending the money that they get from the government and from donors on secretaries and accountants and pension schemes and properties? So if we do have a duty of care towards those type of people that you mentioned in your outline, our duty of care is to make sure the money we do spend is spent as well as possible. And let us not throw out the babies, the very well-intentioned, the very hard-working, the very laudable work of people, the length and breadth of Ireland involved in these, without first having our questions properly framed.
Well, when you were within the housing agency, did you see a number of NGOs and or charities, because some charities are NGOs and some aren't, I accept that. But did you see duplication?
Oh, huge amounts. Huge amounts.
In what?
At the time I was doing it, at the time I was doing it, I think there were 23 homeless charities in Dublin.
Alone?
Employing nearly 900 people, full-time equivalents, in Dublin, servicing a number of homeless rough sleepers who are a fraction of that.
I think they would probably argue that their work goes beyond just supporting rough sleepers in Dublin.
Just saying. The
Noni
numbers
Blackwell?
Are frightening.
OK, that took back to the point that Independent Ireland remain. They are saying, look, there is duplication, there is streamlining. 33,000 is too many for a country of our size.
So of that...
And Conor Skehan backing that up.
Yeah, so there are about 11,500 charities in Ireland. Registered charities, regulated by the charities regulator. Insofar as they get state funding, they get state funding to do work that the state asks them to do. Every single one of them has an agreement with the state to carry out certain work. Every single one of them has to put in accounts every year. They have to keep the money they get from the state to do the work the state gives them to do along the way. So there are 11,500 of those. There's about 20,000 other organisations that are not charities. Mm. All of these together, of course, the disagreement now comes about definition, because all of these together are organisations which are not people working for themselves in their own homes. They're not commercial organisations working for profit, and they're not the state. These are people who are working for the good of the country. They are not-for-profit organisations. They are there to carry out either charitable services Or the other thing, which I think probably vexes certain politicians more than others, they are there to protect the rights of the people who live in this country, whether they are their civil liberties, whether they are their rights to housing, health, justice, education. They are schools, they are hospitals, they are also organisations which hold our state up and say we could do better. And
are they lobbyists, though, as well, would you say?
So they, insofar as they are working very often on the front lines, identifying issues, working with people who are on the margins and otherwise wouldn't have a voice, they are very often making the voices of those people heard, insofar as that is advocating for change, for better Ireland, okay, for human rights. It's lobbying. And like every other lobbyist, charities, other non-governmental organisations all have to sign up to the register of the lobbying register as well. You know, that's kind of normal.
Okay,
everyone
but I suppose, the point that Conor was making and the point that this group are making, this new political party, is you have a city the size of Dublin and you have somewhere, we believe, between 23 and I think maybe 25.
It could be different. It could be more, it could be less.
But approximately that, working within this city.
Yeah. So
is there overlap?
Well, there is more than one shop selling the same thing at a regular rate as well. There are different people doing different pieces of work. Some of them are tiny little community cafes working in their own area. They're grassroots organisations. They're coming from different areas. There are some people working in the housing area who are working with particularly vulnerable people who are in need of housing. Others working with children. So there's a variety of
them. So they're all required, you would say?
I don't know if every one of them is required. What I do know is that there is no money in the sector to manage mergers. Conor, I think, said, you know, there were accountants. There aren't enough accountants, if you ask me. There aren't enough people who can identify where there could be better streamlining. The state is funding.
But I suppose I wonder, is there any desire from the government to look at this sector, to look at perhaps the amalgamation of some of these groups.
But before, sorry Fiona, just one second, and I'll only take a second on this. I mean, the Independent Ireland Party also points out in their manifesto, they talk about streamlining, they also talk about the vital services provided by this sector. Sorry.
Therein lies the problem. I mean, Conor is right. But who's going to these agencies? Is the state going to these bodies and saying, we need you to provide these homeless services? Why do we need approved housing bodies in Ireland at all? Because the councils are not doing the job they used to do up until the 80s and the 90s of actually building public housing.
So instead, we are subcontracting the job out to another organisation,
using public money, fending it, putting it out to them, then ye build the houses, ye manage the list of who takes them up and so on and so forth, because we're the government and we don't want to do it.
But they have, in fact, in lots of cases, you'll find where the non-governmental organisation has added value. They've brought in social workers into a thing, or they've brought in people who deal with drug issues or whatever.
OK, but to the point that was made, and it was made not only by Independent Ireland, it was made by people within Fine Gael over the last 6 months, and I think beyond as well, that they perhaps represent a particular viewpoint in this country. David Quinn writing in the Sunday Independent this week saying not enough of these NGOs represent perhaps a more traditional viewpoint. Would you agree with that, Conor?
Well, I think that that's the beginning of the slippery slope. Nolene has identified the fact that many charities and NGOs also see themselves as advocates and activists. And that's where the difficulty begins. When we're giving money to people who are also activists in a particular field, that's where it begins to become unfair. That's where people who have less access to lawyers and media training are left dumb, are left behind.
And do you think that's happening? Do you think there is a certain viewpoint within this country?
You're the person who quoted it at the beginning. You started to talk about how not one but two political parties are raising this issue.
But I'm asking you personally, is your experience of somebody who would have perhaps canvassed opinion or got opinion from different NGOs when you were working in the housing agency, did you feel that all views in society were being represented equally and fairly?
there's no such thing as equal. There's certainly an equality of opportunity. And it is undoubtedly the case that people who are professionally represented by NGOs that have got good, deep media pockets and media training, like the trades unionists and the SME organisations we just saw before the break, they will always be heard. They will always be the squeakiest wheel. That is true.
Fiona, do you think all viewpoints are being fairly equally represented by the NGO sector in this country?
Well, I mean, whether he's publicly funded or not, David Quinn is himself the head of an NGO in his own right. There's certainly a lot of this argument now is stemming from the defeat of the recent referenda and the suggestion that this was government listening to outside of government bodies telling them this is the way to go.
And I mean, in fairness, Peter Burke, we mentioned Peter Burke in the last session, he did say, did he not, on radio after this referenda, that perhaps we do need to look as a government at the opinions that we are taking from NGOs because they didn't, by and large, reflect the viewpoint of communities in Ireland who voted no to all of those referenda.
But that's failure.
That is what he said.
That's failure by politicians. I mean, they obviously have to weigh things up. I mean, I think it's a positive thing that the Minister for Social Welfare every summer will meet with organisations that are involved on the front line in terms of dealing with people in poverty and saying, I'm framing my budget, share with me your views on where we're going to go. She doesn't turn around though from there going, well, I'm going to do exactly what these people are telling me to do. It's up to the politicians to weigh these things up. And if basically people in government are saying, well, we weren't listening to the right people here, well, then that's their fault.
But perhaps the argument we made is there should be more NGOs there representing.
You want more NGOs? No. How many
just,
more? You want another 5,000 on top, do you?
Right. The counter view.
I think Ciara, NGOs are a different part of our society. They are a bridge between the private and commercial on the one hand and the state on the other. They grow up out of a need for a voice. They will not succeed if there is not something there that they have to say. It is a matter then that if we lose that capacity to hear other points of view other than the state, other than commerce, then we will actually lose a whole vulnerable area.
The reason I'm sitting here is because I'm trying to stop a sector that I desperately care about from harming itself. And in harming itself, it will harm those people it purports to help.
Can you expand on that? What do you mean?
The excesses. We are talking about excesses. Excessive numbers, excessive influence, excessive activism is going to harm their status as being a treasured part of society. And it happens all the time. Hubris, people overplaying their hand, it's a classic way. And you regularly report on this type of thing as a responsible journalist. Overreach, it's the name, it's called overreach. Overreach is the single most damaging thing you can do.
What do you mean by excessive influence? Like, every non-governmental organisation that makes a point, based on what it has learned and what it thinks could be a better solution, about what it thinks could make for a better society, it makes its point. It is very hard to get heard. It is very hard to get Fionnuala's attention sometimes, or somebody else. It's hard to get the attention here of Virgin Media. But they are points that we would sincerely make in the work we are doing ourselves. That's not our excessive influence. That is years banging on about one or two things and very occasionally getting some bit of progress in our area. That's what it looks like from the position of those who work in that democratic space, which is non-governmental organisations.
Look, I'm going to have to leave that conversation there for now. My thanks to Nolene Blackwell and to Conor Skehan for joining us on the programme. Up next, we mark 6 months of the Israel-Gaza conflict. Do stay with us. Welcome back. Well, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has stated that a date has been set for an invasion of the southern Gazan city of Rafah, where over 1 million Palestinians are sheltering. This comes 6 months into the Israel-Gaza war, in which 34,000 people have died, millions have been displaced, and 129 hostages remain unaccounted for. Fionnuala Sheehan has stayed with me, and he's also joined by the CEO of ActionAid, Carol Balfe. Carol, you're welcome to the programme. Netanyahu has said he has set a date for this ground offensive. He hasn't actually said what that date is yet, but you believe that now that he has said it, this will go ahead, this will happen. What does it mean for the people in that area?
Yeah, so the ground offensive of Rafah would be absolutely catastrophic for the people of Gaza. 1.5 million people are currently crammed into Rafah. They have been forcibly displaced, many of them five or six times. It would be a bloodbath if there was a ground offensive. And we know the Israelis are planning for an evacuation of the area. And again, we've seen how this has played out in the war. There was an evacuation order in October for 1.1 million Palestinians. They were sent to Khan Yunis. They were attacked on the way. They weren't provided with humanitarian aid. And then they were moved from Khan Yunis. So history, the immediate history speaks clearly. We should be very, very worried and concerned by this proposed date and the plans of the Israeli military.
And what we did also see today was footage of some Gazan people returning to Khan Yunis now that the Israeli troops have withdrawn from that area. What have they returned to?
So many of them have returned to rubble, essentially, what was their home. So the city has been absolutely destroyed, and people describing with absolute devastation, you know, their houses aren't there, schools have been bombed, hospitals have been attacked.
Is there any infrastructure left in an area like that?
So the north and the central Gaza have been particularly badly destroyed. So we know that 70% of the civilian infrastructure and other facilities have been destroyed. So really very little is left for the people there.
So that's roads, schools, hospitals, homes, all wiped out.
The entire infrastructure that you need, you know, homes, yeah, as you say, schools. And unfortunately, what we find, this represents a pattern of behaviour and a systematic feature of this really awful and horrendous conflict. And it is not an accident. And, you know, the forced displacement of Gazans in this phase of the Israeli-Palestinian relationship needs to be looked in the context of forced displacement that Palestinians have experienced, in fact, since 1922, 1948, 1967, and in the West Bank as well, which is not getting attention because so much attention is rightly focused on Gaza. We have seen about 1,200 Palestinians displaced. And this has been a consistent and systematic policy of dispossession and creating refugees by the Israeli government.
The big fear now is if this ground offensive goes ahead in Rafah, as Carol has described, it will be a bloodbath for the million plus people who are displaced there. Is there anything that would stop Netanyahu from going ahead? Does anybody have influence at this point, Fiona?
America. And if you look at the list of countries that are supplying arms to the Israeli military, there's plenty of EU countries in that list in their own individual right. So very definitely the US and Europe still hold significant influence if it can be directed in a particular manner. Our own government is looking to express its views for what that's worth, but also carry that through on a EU level.
These peace talks that are currently happening in Cairo, John Kirby from the White House today saying, you know, the ball is very much in Hamas's court. We have given them a proposal. Let's see if they come back.
Yeah, still a big emphasis is being placed on the victims of kidnapping, the release of all of those hostages who still remain a bargaining tool. And one would kind of look at that and say, right, is that a potential deal maker in terms of the release of hostages? Would that bring about force a ceasefire on the Israeli side? And that would appear to be part of the negotiation from the negotiators' perspective. The intermediaries see that as a key element as well.
And yet this evening, Carol Balfour, hearing from those negotiations, very conflicting reports over whether or not any progress is being made. And as you said, this is 6 months into this war.
And I think along with the political, we need to remember the legal obligations that countries have, and that includes America and the European Union, countries in the European Union, because these are political negotiations that are happening. But this is the context where we are talking about a strong risk of genocide that the International Court of Justice has clearly said. We're talking about famine, the starvation and collective punishment of a population, aid being restricted, even with the two further access points being open over the weekend, not enough aid is getting in. So states have moral and legal obligations, and America is seriously failing and at risk of complicity. And I think that is one of the clear things. If America stopped arming Israel, this could stop pretty quickly.
We have, as we've been talking about in the programme for a fortnight now, a new Taoiseach tomorrow in Simon Harris. Does your organisation have any expectation that he will take a tougher stance on Israel?
So I think the Irish government has consistently been strong in its call for a ceasefire, and in the context of other countries who have been very weak, that has been very welcome. But again, going back to the point that we're talking about the risk of genocide, we're talking about famine and starvation. Mm. I don't think we can say that any government has really gone far enough and strongly enough. And I think relationships with Israel need to be contingent on this war stopping and ending the ongoing blockade and occupation of the West Bank and Gaza.
Did you get any sense at the weekend when Simon Harris was speaking, and he did talk about ceasefire now and the Irish people being repulsed at the atrocities that we're seeing in Israel, did you get any sense that he is going to change this government's position when it comes to Israel?
No, I think his perspective will be that you continue on the path that you are now. You express your views in the strongest possible terms. You see what legal and political avenues are available to you. Simon Harris made those views about reason being replaced by revenge, and got very warm, very strong support from the audience earlier on in the day. There was a debate about the occupied territories bill, which would basically ban exports from occupied areas, and that was voted down pretty comprehensively within Fine Gael. So there's still, they're still, they haven't gone completely over to the left, where other left-wing parties would be on this issue of relations with Israel.
Does that disappoint you, Carol?
Absolutely. I think this cannot be business as usual. We're talking about genocide here, so the government needs to do absolutely everything, and we cannot wait for the European Union to take action, which is one of the main reasons that the government has resisted supporting this bill. The Genocide Convention sets out clear obligations on countries to act and prevent genocide. We have to do everything in our power.
All right, look, we're going to leave it there for now. My thanks to Fiona Sheehan, to Carol Balfe, and to all of my guests for joining me this evening. That's it from the late team here on The Tonight Show. Good night. Take care.